Okay, John chapter 6. We'll be looking at two more signs this evening, if we have time, in John chapter 6. Just by way of introduction, I want to read from John chapter 20 and verse 30 and 31 that we read this when we first started the book of John, and it tells us what the book of John centers around. What's it all about? Because we'll be looking at two signs this evening. And in John 20, 30, it says, "Therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name." So John specifies the reason that he wrote the book and the reason that he talked about the miracles and or the signs, as he calls them. And we'll be looking at some of those signs. And remember when we first started the book, talked about the seven signs that John talks about in the Gospel of John. Remember the first one was changing the water to wine, and we had that back in chapter 2, verse 1 through 11. And then we had healing the nobleman's son in 4:46 through 54. Now remember, when he healed the nobleman's son, that was his long-distance healing. He wasn't even present when he did that. He healed him from another town, in fact. Then we had the healing of the impotent man, as most of the commentaries call it, in 5:1 through 9. Remember, this is the one that got Jesus into so much trouble with the religious leaders of Israel, because he did it on a Sabbath, and they were very, very upset with him. Now, we'll look at the next two, which will be the feeding of the 5,000. That'll be in chapter 6, 1 through 15. And then the walking on water in 6, 16 through 21. And those are the two we're coming up to this evening. And then we have in chapter 9, when we get over there, the healing of the man born blind in 9, 1 through 12. And then 11, 1 through 46 will be the raising of Lazarus. So now we're ready to do a little introduction on chapter 6 of the book of John. And we'll see as we go through this that John chapter 6 is a turning point in the life of Jesus. This will be the chapter where he first talks about his coming death. Look up in verse 51. John 6:51 says, "I am the living bread that came down out of heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread also which I will give for the life of the world is my flesh." So he's making a reference to his upcoming death here. And from this point on, from chapter 6 on, we'll find that the number of disciples will diminish. Look at verse 66. As it says in verse 66, "As a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore." So we have a turning point here. Chapter 6 occurs about 6 months to a year after chapter 5. The little phrase, "after these things," that begins chapter 6 is a very indefinite note of time. It doesn't specify what length of time, but the best scholarship puts it about 6 months to a year after chapter 5. So that's where we're at. Interestingly enough, the miracle that we'll look at first, the feeding of the 5,000, is the only event that's recorded in all four Gospels before Jesus' last visit to Jerusalem. And in fact, it's the only miracle, besides the resurrection, of course, that is mentioned in all four Gospels. So it's a very important one. All four of the Gospels pick up on this feeding of the 5,000, and it appears in all four of the Gospels. Chapter 6 outlines this way. First, we'll have the signs, 6, 1 through 21. As we mentioned before, the feeding of the multitude in 6, 1 through 15, the walking on water in 6, 16 through 21. From there, we'll go on to the discourse, and that'll be in 22 through 59, and this will be the Bread of Life discourse, as we noted when we read the verse, He is the Bread of Life, and then the outcome in verse 60 through 71. So this is an outline of chapter 6. If you want to read ahead, you can use this outline as a guide. Now let's look at the first miracle of chapter 6, or the first sign, I should say. I slip into saying miracle. John calls them signs. The feeding of the multitude. And that'll be in chapter 6, 1 through 15. Let's read it first, starting at chapter 6 and verse 1. After these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, or Tiberias. A large crowd followed him, because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. Then Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was near. Therefore Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming to him, said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread, so that these may eat?" This he was saying to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are these for so many people?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. Jesus then took the loaves, and having given thanks, he distributed to those who were seated, likewise also of the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were filled, he said to his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments so that nothing will be lost." So they gathered them up, and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. Therefore, when the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, "This is truly the prophet who is to come into the world." So Jesus, perceiving that they were intending to come and take him by force to make him king, withdrew again to the mountain by himself alone. Now, as we read through that, there are 3 principal interpretations of this passage, 3 ways of understanding it. And the first one is that the miracle actually took place in the hearts of the people, and it caused the ones who were selfish to share their provisions so that everybody could have enough to eat. The second interpretation is that the meal was more of a sacrament than a real meal, and everybody just took a tiny fragment instead of eating. Verse 11 kind of belies that one, doesn't it, when it says, "Jesus then took the loaves, and having given thanks, he distributed to those who were seated, likewise also of the fish, as much as they wanted." Now, normally at a sacramental meal, and we have communion, we call that a sacrament, and you get a little cracker and a little glass of wine. Normally in communion, I don't say when we're done, "You know, Ray, you look a little hungry yet. You sure you got enough crackers? You want me to give it?" I mean, you know, you don't do that. It's just kind of silly. He says everybody got as much as they want. These two views actually both, they're totally supposition. It has nothing to do with what the text says. So we're going to use the third principle interpretation, as that is that the incarnate Son of God performed a miracle. Augustine made a wonderful comment, and I read this week when I was looking at the commentaries on this text, and it really struck me. I'm going to read it to you. And it's about miracles in general. And he said this, "For certainly the government of the whole world is a greater miracle than satisfying of 5,000 men with 5 loaves. And yet no man wonders at the former, but the latter men wonder at, not because it is greater, but because it is rare. For who even now feeds the whole world, but he who creates the cornfield from a few grains?" And stop and think about that. Jesus Christ created the universe. He sustains the universe. Hebrews. Look at Hebrews chapter 1. And this is really a good comment. Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3 says, "And He is the radiance of His glory." It's talking about Jesus. "And the exact representation of His nature, and upholds all things by the word of His power." He upholds everything. He keeps the universe running. And we wonder that He couldn't feed 5,000 people with bread and fish. It doesn't make sense. I don't understand commentators who will freely admit that God created the universe, that Jesus sustains the universe, and yet when they come to have Him feeding 5,000 people, they balk. And they, oh, boy, I don't know if scientists are going to laugh at me when I say He can do this. So they come up with a goofy interpretation like that. Anyway, back to the text. I just thought that was a very interesting comment that Augustine made. And we'll look at the setting. And the setting is given in verse 1 through 4 of chapter 6. In verse 2, we have the reason for the crowd. Verse 2 says, "A large crowd followed Him because they saw the signs which He was performing on those who were sick." So the crowd was following Him because He was providing for their physical needs. He was healing sick people. And that's the reason they were following Him around. Now, we'll notice in this verse, make a little grammatical note here, if you're not following along in the Greek text, and that is that there are three imperfect verbs in this verse, and they all indicate continuous action. An imperfect verb in Greek talks about continuous action in the past. So John is saying, as he writes this, a large crowd kept following Jesus all the time. Why? Because they continually saw the signs that He habitually did. You get the idea that this wasn't a one-time occurrence. They were always following Him around. Why? Because they were always seeing the signs that He always did. So it was a continuous thing, a process here. Now, just a historical note. In verse 1, it says, "After these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee," or Tiberias. Now, why does He give two names for that sea? Well, the reason is that this sea was renamed. It was named after a town that was built on its shores. This town was founded in 20 AD and named after the emperor. So that's where the Tiberias comes from. It was probably called Galilee by the locals and the Christian church when Jesus was in His ministry. But when John wrote the gospel, remember this was later. He didn't write this as it was happening. He wrote it later. And he notes here, well, that's called Tiberias now. It's kind of an interesting historical note. It's one of those things that makes the gospel so real. You know, it doesn't seem like something someone would put in if he was making it up. He gives both of the names, the name that was current at Jesus' ministry, and then the name that it was later called. And just a note on the spiritual setting, in verse 3 and 4, it says, "Then Jesus went up on the mountain, and there He sat down with His disciples." Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was near. Two things to mention about this. First, when Jesus retired to a mountain, generally it was to pray. Almost always when He went to a mountain, it was to pray. And the second thing to mention is that the Passover here is not the final Passover where Jesus was crucified. It's not that time yet. So with that, we move on to the test. And Jesus is going to test the faith of Philip in verse 5 through 7. Verse 5 says, "Therefore Jesus, lifting up His eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming to Him, said to Philip, 'Where are we to buy bread so that these may eat?' This He was saying to test him, for He Himself knew what He was intending to do. And Philip answered Him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little. So Jesus, and he knows here, he knows that Philip had not grasped the teaching of verse 5. And he'd done miracles before. I mean, this is the fourth miracle now that we're at. And apparently those miracles, and remember, it's an imperfect tense down here. He was continually doing miracles. That's why the crowd was continually following him. Apparently, this hadn't convinced Philip yet. And look at John chapter 14. Philip has a little trouble getting this through his head, that Jesus Christ is God as much as God the Father is God. In chapter 14, verse 9, it says, Jesus said to him, "Have I been so long with you, and yet you have not come to know me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'?" So Philip still didn't catch on, even after Jesus is going to test him here specifically. If we ask why did Jesus ask Philip to find the food, there are two answers. From a human standpoint, you could say that he asked Philip because Philip lived here. He lived nearby in Bethsaida. In chapter 1, in verse 44, it says that. It says, "Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter." He lived close by, and it would be logical for him to be the one to know where you could go buy food. So Jesus asked him. Now the divine reason is that Jesus wanted to test him. He wanted to show Philip. He wanted to teach him something here. Now in verse 7, back at chapter 6, it says, "And Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little." Now apparently, Philip was able to dig up 200 denarii. That must be where that figure comes from. And he's saying, "Hey, it's not enough. You know, I went around and took up a collection. This is all I could come up with. It's not going to be enough to feed all these people." So Philip focuses in on the impossibility. The test was simply this, was to determine whether Philip would believe that Jesus was capable of meeting a need without human assistance. That's a test we sometimes fail, isn't it? Is Jesus capable of meeting a need without human assistance? And that's the test that Jesus is giving to Philip. Now Andrew chimes in verse 8 and 9, and it says, "One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, 'There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are these for so many people?'" So Andrew, at least he comes forward with an option, but not much of an option, is it? 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, and they're going to feed 5,000 people with that? Now I take it that Andrew went out on a reconnaissance to see how much food he could come up with, and all he could come up with was this little kid. The word lad here is what's called a double diminutive in Greek. It's a little, a little kid, you might say, or a little boy, little tyke, might translate that. So it's just this little kid, and he's got barley loaves, so apparently he wasn't very well off. Barley loaves was the cheap kind of bread, very inexpensive, the kind the poor folks ate. So he finds this boy with the loaves and the fish. And then in verse 10 through 13, Jesus does the miracle. It says, "Jesus said, 'Have the people sit down.' Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. Jesus then took the loaves, and having given thanks, he distributed to those who were seated, likewise also of the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they were filled, he said to his disciples, 'Gather up the leftover fragments so that nothing will be lost.' So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten." Now, the first thing Jesus does is to give thanks. And this connects God the Father with the miracle. And Jesus habitually does that. He connects God the Father. Remember, he said, I don't do anything apart from him who sent me. Look at chapter 11. And it kind of explains it over there. In chapter 11, verse 41, and this will be at the raising of Lazarus. Verse 41 says, so they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. So again, he gives thanks to God the Father, and he links him to the miracle. 42, I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it, so that they may believe that you sent me. So what he does is he relates God the Father so that everybody else can know he's connected to him. That's the reason he does that. In verse 43, it says, when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, out here. And that's how it kind of reads in the Greek. It says, Lazarus, out here. So he raises Lazarus. And see how he connects God the Father and connects himself with God the Father? Now back at chapter 6, we have verse 11 and 12 give us just briefly a divine view of ecology. How do we relate as Christians to ecology? And this is a subject that really polarizes people, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, you have people that says you can't touch a tree because you'll hurt it. You can't harm an animal because they're equal with people. And then on the other hand, you have, well, let's strip mine North America. You know, who cares? Let's get it over with. Tear everything up. And what we're going to find here is God's view of ecology is a very balanced one. Look at verse 11. There was bountiful provision, and everybody shared in it. Everybody took some. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with taking God's provision. God provides for us bountifully, and we should accept it graciously. And yet verse 12 says, when they were filled, he said to his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments so that nothing will be lost. So on the one hand, you have bountiful provision, and on the other hand, you have careful preservation. Now, most people think those concepts won't go together, that those two, they're mutually exclusive. You know, either you're a preservationist or you're a waste-the-environment person. That's not true. The believer's view should be, okay, I'll enjoy what God has given me. He's given it to me graciously. I can enjoy it graciously, but I won't be wasteful. I'll be very careful. I'll preserve what he has trusted me with. So just in two verses here, we have the divine view on ecology and how provision relates to preservation. Now in verse 14 through 15, we have the results of the miracle. And the results are going to be, one, a correct interpretation of the miracle, and two, an incorrect application. Verse 14 is the correct interpretation. It says, therefore, when the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, this is truly the prophet who is to come into the world. Now look back at Deuteronomy 18. This is what they're talking about. And they're making a very correct interpretation of Deuteronomy 18:15. Now remember who wrote Deuteronomy? First five books of the Bible, Moses wrote the Pentateuch. And in verse 15 of Deuteronomy 18, it says, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen. You shall listen to him. So we have a Moses-like prophet that was to come, and that was fulfilled by Jesus. So they had the correct interpretation that Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecy of Deuteronomy 18:15. But they made an incorrect application of that. Now, what would you think if you were a Jew, and probably most of us aren't Jews, so we can't think like that, if you made that connection in your mind, you made the connection, wow, this is the prophet like Moses. What did Moses do? He freed his people from political oppression. He freed them from slavery. Naturally, they assumed, if this is the Moses-like prophet, Jesus is going to free us from the bondage of the Roman Empire. So they were thinking in political terms. They failed to see the spiritual nature of his first mission. Now, he will do that, but not, he didn't do it at the first advent. So they failed to see the spiritual nature of his mission. So what did they come up with? Verse 15, so Jesus, perceiving that they were intending to come and take him by force to make him king. Well, it's only natural. This guy is the Moses-like prophet. We're going to make him king so he can get us free of the Roman Empire. Well, that's not what Jesus was there for at the time. So we have the last part of verse 15 where it says he withdrew again to the mountain by himself alone. Now that brings us to the walking on the water in verse 16 through 21. Let's read those now. Starting at verse 16, it says, now when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea. And after getting into a boat, they started to cross the sea to Capernaum. It had already become dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea began to be stirred up because a strong wind was blowing. Then, when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near to the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, it is I, do not be afraid. So they were willing to receive him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. Now there's also two interpretations of this miracle. The liberal interpretation goes like this. Well, the ship was near the land, and Jesus was walking down the beach, and they thought he was walking on water. That's what the liberal interpretation would be. Now, remember, John was there. John was a fisherman on the Sea of Galilee. I'll bet he knew the difference. I mean, I would just say, notice, he specifically mentions how far out they were. It says, then when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles. So it specifically mentions that they're out here in the sea and Jesus appears and walks on the water. So again, we'll not take the liberal interpretation. We'll take the conservative one that says that if God can maintain the universe, he can create a universe and maintain it, that he can probably walk on water without too much trouble. Now, if we compare these two signs, we'll find out they have a little different focus. The first sign, the feeding of the multitudes, or the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus and his relationship to the crowd, to the multitudes. Now, this one, the walking on the water, focuses in on the relationship of Jesus to his disciples. So we're focusing in now on the relationship of Jesus and his disciples. We can outline this little section this way. First, the absence of Jesus, and I'll show why I point that out in a moment, in verse 16 through 18, and then the return of Jesus in 19 and 20, and the presence of Jesus in verse 21. So first we have Jesus' absence in verse 16 through 18. And it says in here, now when evening came, the disciples went down to the sea, and after getting into a boat, they started to cross the sea to Capernaum. It had already become dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. Now, if you look at Matthew 14, and this is another account, in Matthew 14, in verse 22, it explains why Jesus wasn't with them. And you'll note it's not just a chance event. Jesus told them to go on alone because he's going to test them. And it says in verse 22, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side. Well, he sent the crowds away, talking about the same event there. So we add that to what we have in John, and we see that this was not a chance event. Jesus knew what was going to happen. He sent the disciples on ahead. The disciples had a lesson to learn. And they had to learn the lesson that their very lives depended on him. So how is he going to teach them that lesson? Well, he's going to teach them by scaring them out of their pants. Or out of their wits, pardon me. That's how he's going to teach them this lesson. And the lesson is going to be simply this. Just because Jesus isn't bodily with them, that does not mean he's not aware of them. We need to know that lesson too, don't we? Just because Jesus isn't standing down here in the front row, that doesn't mean he's not aware of us. He's very much aware of us. Verse 19 and 20, he returns, and it says in verse 19, then when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near to the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." An interesting way he puts it in verse 20, "It is I," is literally, well, those are the Greek words, ego eimi. Ego eimi means I am. That's what he said to them. He said, "I am." Now, this is kind of a flag, and what it flags or what it denotes is that an emphatic claim or identification is about to happen. And you have to look in the context to see what that claim is. Look at chapter 9 and verse 9, for example. In chapter 9 and verse 9, it says, "Others were saying, 'This is he.' Still others were saying, 'No, but he is like him.' He kept saying, 'I am.'" And we have it translated, "I am the one," because it's emphatic there. So he emphatically claims, "This is me, here I am," and he's walking on the water. Now, verse 21, when he gets into the boat, it says, "So they were willing to receive him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going." Now, this may refer to a miracle or not. Obviously, Jesus is capable of, what should we call it, beaming the boat over to where they were going. He could have done that, but again, it could simply mean that John is saying, well, we immediately got to where we were going because there wasn't any further delay. Either way, you can take that one either way. Now, the first two, I'll stand up and say those are miracles. This one could be just John's way of saying that Jesus fixed everything, the storm stopped, we got there immediately. That's the walks on water miracle. Now, next week, we'll look at the discourse, and that will be the bread of life discourse. And we'll start there on verse 22 next week. Father, thank you again for your word, and thank you for John's gospel, where John declares to us that he's pointing out miraculous signs that Jesus did so that we may believe, so that we may have eternal life by believing that he is your son, he is God, he became a man, he died on the cross to pay the penalty for our sins. It's in his name we pray. Amen.